Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. In keeping with the theme of the Kingsmead Book Fair, we bring you another very special guest. I think we're realizing that the theme of our time at the Kingsmead Book Fair is the memoir, the memoir, the memoir. Mm. So we have a wonderful guest today, and I'm just going to read the blurb because it's my thing, and Nkokonolo so eloquently exposed me on another podcast. I just have a thing for blurbs, guys. I have a thing for blurbs because they're so... It's so interesting, the kind of stuff that people think is important to be the first contact with the reader.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to read Landa's blurb, which also just had me read it through the book. So it goes, in April 1981, Landa Mabenge enters this world trapped in a girl's body. From the start, Landa is aware that he does not relate to his female form, despite being socialized as a girl. At age 11, his world is shattered when an angry woman and her zombie-like husband arrive in Mtata to force him to accompany them to Port Elizabeth. Life in PE with the parents soon morphs into a Dickinson nightmare. Landa is subjected to horrific abuse as he descends into a world of isolation and shame. I counted the years I will have to remain a slave. There are 7 before my redemption. 7 times 365 is 2,555 days. Today is nearly at an end. By the end of tomorrow, there will be 2,554. By the end of the week, 2,548. And so I will myself on. Eventually, the day will come when I will be free. At 18, Landa is finally able to escape PE to study at UCT, where he tries to embrace life as a butch lesbian, but he remains tortured by his female body. After a close-to-death breakdown, Landa finds strength to embark on an arduous 4-year-long journey to physically and legally become him. In 2014, he makes history by becoming the first known transgender man in South Africa to successfully motivate a medical aid to pay for his surgeries. Both heartbreaking and uplifting, becoming him is a groundbreaking story of torture and triumph, bravely opening the lid on cultural shame and abuse against those who choose a path less traveled. It gives me so much pleasure to introduce today's guest, Landa Mabenge, who is a passionate transgender activist and educationalist through his consultancy, Landa Mabenge Consulting. He's also UCT graduated. In 2017, he was selected as a Nelson Mandela Washington Fellow for young African leaders. Ooh. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, guys. Yo, this has been...
What a do, though.
Yeah.
I mean, firstly, awesome. We also have to say, now I'm sitting in the presence of greatness because we have an alum of the Yali Fellowship.
Yeah.
And Alma will be jetting off to the US of A to do the same program. Yay. So, okay, you know, Yali people.
Yali
people.
Rocks.
Yes.
So, Landa, how are you doing?
I'm good, guys. I'm good. It's good to be in Joburg, invited to the Kingsmead Book Fair.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, no, life is good.
Cool. Hey, Landa is now a regular at these book fair things. I mean, we saw pictures of him at Franschhoek just...
Yeah, last weekend.
Last weekend. This weekend he's in Joburg. Listen, Slayer's King.
And also he's an Alan Payton long listee.
Yeah.
Okay, come through.
Wait, King, we are surrounded by black excellence today. We are in the presence of it.
So, I just want to... start at the beginning, obviously. Mm. Your book is called Becoming Him, a trans memoir of triumph, right? I think that you chose those words particularly, you know, a trans memoir of triumph.
Mm.
So tell us about the title of the book and how it came about.
So the title of the book actually came much, much, much later. Going through the manuscripts, reading and rereading this book, the resounding theme was the, you know, always being able to come out of any sort of situation that life threw at me, especially my time in PE as a child, and then also going back into depression, into isolation, into shame because of my the battle that I had with my gender and sexuality at the time. So I actually went to the dictionary and I looked at what it means to become, and it's to begin to be. Mm-hmm. So I feel my life has been I've been reinvented so many times, and it's always so beautiful to see how I've come out of different phases and moved into to the next phase of my life. And also the butterfly morphing into coming out of a caterpillar. My granny and I spoke about that, and I put it in the book. So that analogy for me also spoke to the beauty of becoming. And so the trans memo of triumph, I mean, Melinda was very keen in terms of coming up with this title. The trans memo of triumph is, again, the life story, the battles, the ups, the downs, the ebbs, the flows of my life. And obviously, it was necessary for me to have trans within there, because as a transgender man who is out and proud, who is able to live a full life in spaces where others cannot, I had to put it out there so that whoever needed to connect with it can connect with it from the title, from the word go.
And we'd like you to read just some parts of the prologue, just to get the listeners, you know, titillated on what this amazing memoir.
So I can just start at the beginning. Yes. My first memory of feeling like I was a boy is when I'm only 7 years old. I feel a weird excitement every time I am near my younger cousin, Minky. We grow up side by side, and between feeding chickens and ducks and watering our grandmother's ever-thirsty garden, we play children's games, which always include playing house. I am permanently glued to her shadow, always insisting that she be the mother, while I floric around with my shirt unbuttoned playing father. I feel genuine affection for her. She is also extremely beautiful.
Ooh, okay, I mean, with a prologue like that, why wouldn't you want to read on?
I think we're done. We can just get Lala to read more from his book, and then we'll tell people where to get the book. But this book is particularly powerful because of the themes that you touch upon so eloquently in the book. And I mean, memoirs are very, very personal. They require a sort of intimacy and allowing people to look into the personal, which then becomes the public, So I want to know what then made you decide to write this particular book. You could have written any book, but you chose to write this memoir at this time in your life.
So yeah, you're right. I mean, you're putting your life out there for the world to pick apart as they please, you know. It also carries a lot of implications, especially with the themes of my book, because I am not an island. I don't exist in a silo. I've got family. I've got, you know, relatives. So it also tests those relationships, because suddenly what's been concealed behind closed doors is in the public now. You know, so I've always wanted to write a book. I've written, you know, I began writing very young, and during my time in therapy when I was at UCT, I used to journal a lot.
Yes.
And at that time, I felt, you know, this urge that I need to tell my story, but the motivation was wrong. I wanted to expose my parents, you know. And so the writing kind of like stopped at some point, and then it picked up again when I met Melinda and started the writing workshops. But I felt I had to tell the story. This is, you know, this experience, my experiences are unique to me, but these experiences are common amongst a lot of people, especially Black people. I felt that there needed to be a narrative that speaks to the traumas that we go through, that some people have gone through, which might or might not have anything to do with gender or sexuality, but which taint Black communities and Black families a lot. So that was the motivating factor.
One of the key things which you mentioned in speaking about why you wanted to write the book was, in some ways, to excavate and bring to the fore abuse, particularly in the familial sense, right? Yeah. Why did you think, I mean, talk to us about like the journey of including that particular part. Because on the one hand, it's you are revisiting parts of your life that are very painful. You know, how was that? But also why you felt it was important for you to include it in your memoir.
But also now with the benefit of therapy and having been able to look at it from outside, you know, the book has been written, you've read it, you now have had a chance to process this from outside. I want to know what that process has then been like.
So I felt it necessary to, because it's part of my journey, right? It's part of my becoming. And at certain points unbecoming, because there was a lot of regression, especially in terms of the mental health element of my life. So I felt it's necessary to include, because in weaving this tapestry of my life, it's a very big part of my life. And it's a part that showed me, or has come to show, that I was able to make it. You know, I had that resolve to keep pushing, to keep going, to keep going, to keep going. And I mean, as a child, you never really understand that you are strong enough until being strong is the only choice you have. So that was the reason why. It's an integral part of my life. Also, because I was born and raised in love for the first part of my life, then I moved into trauma, into pain, into abuse, and then I came out again, and I had people who walked my journey with me and returned me to love. So I thought it was very important to show how one's life can come full circle, especially coming out of trauma. It was very difficult. There were days I didn't want to wake up because looking and going back into that darkness, I had a fear that I wouldn't come out. And having worked extensively in therapy, it's a lot of work. If you wanted to work, you need to invest yourself, and it's quite draining. So the lover was very key in terms of, you know, being my right hand and assisting me, especially on days when I didn't want to get out of bed. But looking from the outside now that it's been written, there are days where I'm like, how did you make it? You know? Because, again, our families are very, they're brilliant at masking the truth, the trauma. You know, you can go into any space and you will find that, wow, these guys are like hectic, you know? So I read it and I realize, yo, this is hectic, but I'm also grateful that I got the opportunity to write it and tell it, because I've had so many people connect, especially with those parts of my story, and have been then able to go and seek help for themselves. So yeah, it's there are days when it still feels very surreal. I always, like the friend of mine, Tandi, that I speak about in the book, we're still very close. Up until today, we sit down and we're like, but Nanda, what could have possibly happened to your mother? You know, why was she like? So it's coming from that space now. But yeah, very grateful to have been able to write and tell that part.
Speaking of toxicity in family, like you said earlier, you don't exist in a silo, you know, so you've obviously got family. And I want to know, you had the opportunity to obviously go and revisit a lot of these very painful memories, and also visit the ways in which our own families are complicit sometimes through their silence in our mistreatments and in our abuse. And I want to know how writing this book has now framed your relationships with other people in your family. And did it frame the way that you also felt about the adults in your family who may have had an idea of what was happening, but then also just excluded themselves from taking part in protecting you because they wanted to maintain that facade of a family, perfect family.
And I think connected to that is also the relationship between the mother and the father, right?
Yeah.
So there was a sort of gentleness that was extended to you when the mother was not around, that wasn't extended to you when she was around.
Yeah.
So even talking about the toxicity in their relationship, that he became someone else when she was around, but was gentler when she wasn't around.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. The father was like that. And that's why I always say I preferred the mother, because with her, it was always clear cut. I always knew where I stood with her. It was always a case of knowing that there would never be that bond. There would never be that love, you know? I always tell anyone who asks, I'm 38 now, I've never hugged my mother, I've never kissed her, I've never held her hand, save for when she was beating me. So with her, it was simple, open and shut. She was easy. With the father, he had these multiple faces, these personalities, right? And in some instances would go on to say, but hey, Aunt Mazu, Mama, I don't know what's wrong with your mother. But yet they are a team, they are a unit, you know? Bless you. And so it was easier for me to make sense of the mother than the father, because with him I never knew where I stood. But with the family and the ties and the toxicity, it's moved now into spaces where they discuss or they talk about the book. Nobody. There's one maternal uncle who has, he has sent me SMSs calling me a serpent, you know, attacking me personally in terms of my gender identity. Because that's what they always do, right? Mm. When they don't agree with you in principle, they attack the person.
Mm.
And do you know what? It was on the 10th of February this year that we started sending these SMSs, a Sunday. And it's quite, a regular church. It's amazing how humans do these things. And
how particular kind of overly religious zealot.
Right? It's like he's going to make penance before he comes and attacks me. But I actually said to the lover, it felt like the mother was the mother's words, you know, spitting that vitriol at me and stuff like that. But I got to a point where I just switched off because it's not worth my energy. I've worked a lot on who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a right to tell the story of my life and tell it like it is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to be tiptoeing around people's feelings. Some of them feel that as a child, I must have done something to warrant the parents, especially the mother, to treat me the way she did. So it's abuse apologists, right?
Mm.
Most of them, though, don't engage me. Most of them have kind of like just cut me off, which is all good as well, you know? Another theme that you probably might have picked up in the book is that my friends raised me. Coming into UCT, I was still very young. There was a lot of development that needed to happen with me. And so those people are still here. Mm. So whilst I might not be able to choose the family that I was born into, I can choose my family now.
Chosen family is real family.
I love that because it also then makes us question our own ideas. Because in reading this book, I really question my own idea of family and what you really think family to be outside of this nuclear structure that we get taught about and that gets ingrained in our mindsets. I think of your relationship with the mom that you describe as really having been your mother in almost every sense of the word, right? And I think of your relationship with your grandparents and the ways in which our families can really hold us in love in ways that really closely resemble what we think a biological relationship should be like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those normative, like that space where you realize, this nuclear idea is just that, an idea. Mm-hmm. And it's not reality for a lot of people, you know? Oma actually, she couldn't have her own kids. And she died, I think, very sad because she had invested a lot in me as a child. Paid for everything, schooling. Even when I was at UCT before she passed away, she even paid some funds towards UCT.
Mm-hmm.
So that is what I would have expected or would have hoped to have had from the parents, but it doesn't necessarily translate.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go to church on Saturday and Sunday, and we become these holier than everyone else's, but meanwhile, back at the ranch, it's just trauma.
We're taking a short break.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
Mm. I want to talk about, speaking of Saturdays and Sundays and at church, the role of church and the role of organized religion in this book is quite a strong theme for a lot of reasons. It helps to reinforce the toxicity, right, that plays out in your household. But it also reinforces a lot of the feelings of inadequacy and not feeling enough and feeling that you're always going to have to be what you are not in order to fit in.
Mm. And I think also, more importantly, the othering.
Yeah. Yes.
So this religion allows the people in the church, the literal building of the church, to spew these transphobic and homophobic comments that are not translating into the home.
Exactly.
And in the home, you hear the mother, you know, spewing that. Yeah.
Reinforcing that.
And for someone who grew up in organized religion, right, for someone who in some ways, you wanted to please the parents.
Of course.
Because you were like, ah, guys, maybe they will love me if I'm this person.
Exactly.
But there was a lot of othering.
Yeah.
Now, having written that, right, what are your reflections about, like, organized religion and how it participates in othering people?
I think that's where the source of othering actually comes from, especially from our communities, and,
yes,
and especially black communities. We shy away from everything and every element of being human first, and we go and formulate these ideas within that space. I mean, I read somewhere that religion is the only culture that doesn't allow human beings to be, you know? And so I just felt, like you said, I felt that if I really immerse myself in terms of understanding the doctrines of the church and partaking in the youth groups that I was assigned to, the parents, especially the mother, would meet me at we would find equilibrium. And it didn't happen like that, you know? And I always, you know, I could always look at her and think, wow, on the home level, you are the epitome of evil. But when you stand there in front of these masses and you speak about this God and how he's supposed to be loved, it's a whole other world, you know?
And it's like you're a different person.
Exactly.
Like, you are not the same person that just beat me.
Wow.
Or the same person that
or
just
keeps telling me that I'm not going to amount to anything
yeah.
in life.
But it also then plays into the ways in which abusers behave, right? Because then it becomes difficult for people to believe that what you're saying about
exactly.
this person is true.
Right.
Because you come with this account that is true, but is very different to other people's experience of this person. And I think that in reading this book, it also reinforces that, because often people use that as a defense, right?
Yeah.
Like, this person could have never been abusive. She was always so lovely to me, but your experience of a person doesn't nullify that of their victim.
Exactly,
right?
Especially if you're not in company with that person 24 hours a day. And another element of the mother, which is a part of me that I started resenting at some point, is the fact that she had the most amazing voice. She could sing. And I would lose myself, you know, when she sings, and then the minute she stops, reality kicks in.
Mm-hmm.
That that voice is not a reflection of this this person. And I mean, I started singing at a young age. I couldn't even go to choir practice because it was a nuisance in the home, because it's before school. And I hated music at some point, especially when I was depressed, because I felt it was a big connector between me and the mother. Until I allowed myself to actually join a choir and actually enjoy the passions for what they are, you know? So that also takes a lot of work, but also just shows the multiplicity of these personalities and these personas that one has to deal with, especially veiled behind the church, the culture that is the church, the cultism that happens in organized religion.
There's a connection, right, between your mental health, but also thinking about when you talk about body shame, and when you talk about dysmorphia and dysphoria, right? The idea that part of your mental well-being rested on the fact that you didn't feel at home in your body. Do you want to take us through that? Like, that experience of, you know, growing up not feeling like you belong in this body, and having to have this abuse, but also as you're growing older, continuously be in these depressive states, right?
And that socialization as well, which is, honestly, as reading the book, I could feel that that socialization felt so foreign to who you knew yourself to be, you know?
No, definitely. I mean, there are days when I'm like, I want to kick myself that girls at schools are allowed to wear grey pants now. I mean, during my time, that was taboo, you know, which could have possibly lessened some of the impacts of that socialization. But going back to the mental health, the body, the growing up, the abuse, you know, it was a terrible part of who I was. Because even though I grew up in Umtata, raised and socialized as a girl, there were specific liberties in my grandparents' home. Like,
yes,
I could come back from school, wear my pants, you know. Umay and I would argue about the fact that, why can't I wear pants to school, you know? I just didn't fit into this body. It felt like something was not aligning. You know, even as a child, I just felt weird, you know? Mm. And then going to stay with the parents, and that's where my body develops, right? And now I'm starting to have my menses, the breasts are growing on my chest. It was horror, horror, horror. Mm-hmm. And the fact that I couldn't even speak to the mother about it. Because the first person I tell is my brother, and my naive self believes that, okay, it's developing according to
this
what
is what I
need,
want exactly,
you know?
Exactly.
And it's not. And so my brother tells me, there's nothing I can do for you. And I mean, I held on to people when they said, because Ma said that after she had dropped me off. Yes. And then my brother's also telling me that there's nothing he can do for me. And I think that's what also helped me to build my resistance, because I realized at a young age that I'm all I have, if I can put it that way.
Hmm.
Because at some point in my life, someone won't be able to do anything for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so growing up and it was trauma. Going to the church again, at a particular, well, I can say it because it's in the book, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, it doesn't encourage girls to wear pants even outside the church. So again, it's like, whoa. I mean, I find solace in wearing, in dressing the way I feel comfortable in, despite the body. But if you want to take that away from me as well, it sort of like plummets me deeper into this depression. And so getting to UCT, and I think that's where my world collapses, and primarily because this dysphoria is there since inception. So the abuse is the tipping point, yeah, but I've had these mental health issues. I've been having conversations with myself. I have known myself to be who I am, but everyone else seems to have an idea and are telling me, no, you're not this, you are this, you know? And so that's where my life crumbles. And I mean, even getting into same-sex relationships at the time filled that void a little bit, you know, because it still is not me. And there's no, I can't find, there's no words. I don't know how to explain this, which is when I eventually Google what it means to be a man in a woman's body. And that's when I find this, you know, literature, the theories, the language, you know, to be able to quantify, okay, this is what's going on. So, yeah.
So I think that there are two really powerful moments there. The first moment is when you say that even as a child, you knew that there was a disconnect.
Mm.
And I mean, it speaks to this idea that we have that a lot of people use to promote their transphobia.
Mm.
Is to say that, no, we can't let children dress in certain ways or behave in certain ways because they don't know.
Mm.
When the reality is, even as a child, you knew that this disconnect existed.
Mm.
And you knew that there was something in the equation that just wasn't making sense to you as a person, you know? And then to further add on to that is to the finding of the language.
Mm.
And I want to speak about that. Mm. That finding of the language and what it meant to you to find the language of what you were experiencing at the time. Did it make a lot of the dysphoria and a lot of the feelings that you were feeling make sense? What did it do?
It did. Suddenly I could put it into words now. I could understand that, okay, there's a word for this, and it's called being transgender, you know? I think it was Judith Butler who wrote about the politics of the wardrobe.
It is Judith.
Yeah. And, you know, there again, who decides who should wear what, when, how?
Mm.
You know, we were talking about this in class the other day, and we were talking about how our native attire, our traditional wear, everyone is uniform. It's all feminine, if we can call it like that. But now we are so political about gender in terms of even the colors, pink and blue, and we gender everything. The other day I read on Facebook that women must drive Mercedes Benzes and men must drive BMWs. Come on.
What does that mean?
Anyway, excuse my French. But yeah, so finding the language was an aha moment. But a part of that was also a bit depressing, if I can put it like that, because it spoke to mental health. You know, it was a gender identity disorder. And I mean, I've battled with mental health issues all my life. Now, again, that is highlighted. But it felt liberating in the sense that I had people I could now talk to. Mm-hmm. During my research, I found this transgender clinic. I went there, so it eased that burden of.
I suppose also it made you feel less alone.
Yeah. Yes.
Throughout your lifetime, you are constantly fending for yourself and being like, actually, nobody's gonna have my back.
Yeah.
But when you find the language, you find that there are people in the world who exist in this space. So in some ways, it also made you feel not alone.
Yeah.
And to be like, I am seen.
Yeah. This is real. It's not just a figment.
And
of
it highlights
imagination.
The importance of language, right?
Yeah.
It highlights why it's so important to use the correct language when addressing people, to use the correct pronouns, to use words that are not transphobic, to not misgender people, because people make it seem like, oh, the woke warriors are being problematic again, you're being sensitive, but it's not, and for me, this is really something that came out so deeply in the book, is the issue of language and what it means to be able to name yourself, and to be able to name what you're feeling, and to be able to name what is happening to you, and to also be able to not be misnamed.
It's owning yourself, right? It's taking charge of who you are, and we should all have the right to do that. I mean, you are born and you are assigned a gender at birth. You are given a first name. Why can't we give ourselves names? Do you understand what I'm trying to say here? Everything about us is predetermined, and when we decide to own ourselves, our journeys, our lives, then everyone has something to say. So, yeah, I think it's very, very important. And also, just touching back on the misgendering or dead naming, some people will be like, you must give me time to adjust. There's nothing to adjust. It's either you see me or you don't see me. We don't have to sit at the same table. Do you get what I'm saying? It's a conscious thing. Human beings can be very selective about what they want to see and receive in a person
and understand.
Mm.
And
does it still feel
as visceral to have people do that and abuse the language that they use to speak to you? Because I think we underestimate what it does to somebody to dead name them and to misgender them.
It means you don't see me. So it still does. And again, it's about finding ways to work with one's mental health as well. I'm on a quest to just choose the people I hang around now, choose the people who are in my inner circle, and just work with those people. And I mean, even my dead name, I write about it in the book, why I didn't deviate so much from my name, because it connected me to the woman who found herself a mother at 2 days old, you know, well, with this 2 day old child. But again, I should be allowed, if I wanted to be Tom, then I can be Tom. Do you know what I'm saying? It's a choice that I have. It's my liberty. It's my right. People have fought for these rights. People have died ensuring that human beings have the right to be who they are, you know? So it requires a lot of work, a lot of awareness, and you know, choosing the spaces one interacts in, and also the visibility. Maybe I can touch on it.
Mm-hmm.
When I began my journey, there were no black transgender people I could look up to. You know, there were no journeys I could connect to, and so the only person whose journey I found was Cher and Sunny's child, Shaz Bono.
Yes.
And again, I think that's part of the reason why I felt it's important to write this black transgender narrative and put it out there, so that a black transgender child somewhere in the rural village of Mount Elif or wherever who hears about this can know that it's possible to just choose you every time.
There are two very pivotal moments that happen in your life, at least we would like to elevate those pivotal moments.
Mm.
One of them is the medical transition that you undertake, but it was a very arduous journey.
Yeah.
So we want to spend a little bit of a moment talking about that. Then what happens after that is the legal journey that you undertake of becoming. So we think really that elevates the story of why you wrote the book, to be like, you know what, it wasn't all moonlight and roses.
And to add to that, because we speak a lot about the medical and the legal, but we don't often talk about the psychological. So if you could just take us through those three elements, the medical, the legal, the psychological, and why you felt it was important. Because, I mean, that's very intimate, and I don't believe that any of us were entitled to that part of your story. So we feel quite honored that you chose to include what really was a very personal aspect of your story. But I find it so interesting that you went into those aspects, you know, and I want to know
in detail. Even.
In detail, you know, and you really honored your audience with those very personal details.
So so the legal actually comes before the medical, because when I begin my journey, and I engage the panel at Scooter Skiri, the transgender clinical team, given the bureaucracy of our government departments, if I can call it like that, and experiences of other trans people who have gone through to Home Affairs to change their gender markers, to change their first names, the trauma.
Can we just really talk about just a little moment?
Yeah.
Why do we have gender markers in our
That's
continue.
A good one.
Why do we then insist on having these very problematic gender markers and then being problematic in the way that we interact with people who want to change their gender markers?
So again, it's the systems, it's the power. It's a power thing, right? It's an ownership thing. It's an ownership thing. We talk about it and we decide, I decide that, no, I'll break this journey down. Name change first.
Yes.
Then after a while, after I get my new ID, gender marker change.
Mm.
So the name change was very easy. Anyone can change their name. I mean, if you want to have 20 names, if they can fill on the form, you can go and change them. Again, the selectivism, do you get what I'm saying? And then the gender marker change, you need to fill in a form, 2 motivation letters from a specialist who's working with you, and another medical professional.
Mm.
So I get these, but even going into Home Affairs, my phone is on record because I've heard the horror stories.
Yes.
So I'm ready for a fight,
mm.
and my back is up. I went to Weinberg Home Affairs because it was a newer branch at the time and a younger staff complement. And so I thought perhaps it would be easier to try and convince whoever is assisting me, because we get to points where we need to convince people to allow us to be who we are.
Mm.
To try and convince someone there vis-a-vis in the Cape Town branch, which is overworked, much older. So I was like, okay, let's try Weinberg. Went into Weinberg. And, this guy, initially very confused about what I'm presenting to him. But at some point he sees me. He reads the forms. And in engaging with me, he can see that I'm quite irritated.
Mm-hmm.
And he says to me, Mr. Lund, I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to work with you. So he sees me, he has me at that. Because he read everything on the form. And he
says, Mr. Lund.
Yes. So he affirms me.
Mm-hmm.
And we work together. And eventually the forms go off. And I get my new, my gender marker changed and my new ID. So, again, there's that cycle. Because I needed to go in there already prepared psychologically. Right? And emotionally to fight. And this is what a lot of transgender people have to go through.
Mm.
And then the medical side of things comes.
Mm.
Because even though it's not a prerequisite you don't have to have any surgeries to qualify, if I can put it like that, as transgender. Because we kind of like always trying to have to prove to someone.
And I like that point, just to talk about gender essentialism, right?
Yes.
And even queer essentialism.
Yeah.
The idea that you need to be a certain thing in order to fit into a box.
A box.
Because even people in the...
the binaries.
Even people in the community.
Exactly.
Do the same thing.
In the community.
And the conversations about, the very problematic conversations about passing and this, this almost obsession with...
That gatekeeping,
with the aesthetics. In the passing and right? Because what does that then look like for trans people who don't want to medically
who
transition?
Don't have body dysphoria, right? And I mean, it's been happening. Transgender men, and I'm going to say this, especially black transgender men in South Africa who have had top surgery, are big gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, if you haven't had any form of surgery, especially because, I mean, once you remove your breasts and you pass very well in public, you stand up tall, you feel like, I've got this, I've arrived, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's. I think it's the most important part. It's the most important surgery. Well, in any case, for me, it was. Because suddenly, because I was quite huge. So I could pass and stand tall in society. But in our spaces, in our communities, especially the queer community, that toxicity of wanting to police and undermine transgender men who haven't had that privilege and that access that you have had, it's a very big problem.
Mm.
So, for me, the biggest... the medical aid is a big issue because these surgeries are quite expensive, right? And there are only 2 transgender clinics in South Africa, 1 in Cape Town, 1 in Joburg.
Mm.
The waiting list is 21 to 27 years for one of your surgeries.
27 years.
Yeah. So... that for me is not an option. I have labored, I have I have gone through the darkest of hell, and now I'm finally at a point where I want to live my true life, and you're telling me that I'm going to have to wait 21 years?
What does that mean?
I was like, okay, cool, let's try and speak to medical aid. My doctors and I rally, we write the motivations, we send it to my then medical aid, they don't even respond. And then I switched to my then partner's medical aid, which was Bank Med, the K-Cross option. Again, we motivate, they decline. Pick up the phone, I call in and I ask to speak to the case manager. Why are you declining me? No, you don't need these surgeries. But I'm like, but the doctors say I need the surgeries. And I ask her, would it help if I were to perhaps put you in contact with my surgeon who's going to be performing these surgeries? And she's like, yeah, maybe that could help. It just so happens that she knows Kevin Adams. And so after a conversation with the doctor, which is Kevin Adams, they approved my surgeries. Again, I always say this, and I want to say it here as well. I am aware of the privilege that I've had. I am very much aware of it, the access that I've had, which is why I do the work that I do, because I feel it's important that everyone should be able to access the care that they need, especially within the spaces, within the education spaces, but also any community. People need to know what it means to be transgender. Mm. They need to be able to choose themselves, and they need to have access to healthcare.
Tell us about the work that you do, because I think that's an important sort of lead in. I mean, there is an enormous amount of privilege that you have spoken about. I mean, so if someone doesn't have medical aid, what does it look like for them to attempt to medically transition in this country? What are the social implications? What are the psychological implications for somebody who experiences the gender dysphoria but does not have accesses to the surgery that they need?
So the situation is very bleak. Our medical aids are on some, it's not medically necessary, it's cosmetic surgery. And our public healthcare system needs an overhaul, hey? We've got public healthcare professionals who, again, are selective about who and what they want to treat and work with. And the space of transgender is still very foreign to a lot of them. So the work that I do is Lana Mabenga Consulting, which is an independent consultancy that does work with NGOs, works with universities in South Africa to teach on what it means to be transgender, to create awareness, to use my personal story as a resource to catalyze all of those. So it's I think a transgender person, and I can only speak on my experience with authority, but once you can start getting your hormone replacement therapy, you feel that it's a first step towards the bigger end. And so my primary goal is to get transgender people are in touch with mental health specialists so that they can talk. It's important to talk about the journey, especially when you've been existing in a silo, because most of the time you'll find that transgender people exist in their minds and their bodies are just present. So it's important to have a sit down to talk about what it could look like, what could happen, the implications of taking hormone after your body has developed, and then to help them to begin their journeys towards becoming by taking those hormone therapies. I always encourage, especially given my experiences, a lot of transgender people to actually also work on their physical health. Mm-hmm. So as a trans guy, I mean, I know I've kind of like fallen off the wagon, but it helps to go to gym, it helps to run, it helps to keep your body in shape, because then your body works with the hormone. Mm-hmm. And it's important to then continue working with mental health specialists. So a lot of the young people I see, and that is why most of my work is also focused in the education space, because therapy is free there. Mm-hmm. It's just that we need to upskill the therapists on campuses to be able to provide the care that young people need. But in most spaces, I do have great relationships with NGOs. And so whenever someone gets in touch with me, we can link them to, if they don't have medical aid, then I link them to an NGO that provides safe spaces. There's support groups which meet once or twice or three times, you know, a month in certain communities. I mean, I've got a trans man who is in his late 40s who stays in a rural setting, so they've had to be linked to the nearest, but the process starts, you know. So there's still a lot of work that needs to be done, which is why it's also important for these organizations, especially non-governmental, us as independent consultants, and the government spaces, to work together instead of against each other. Because once we work together, then we create safe spaces for a lot of people, and more people can be linked to care.
So there's a part of the book which pertains to romantic relationships, mm-hmm. right? So you enter romantic relationship first as someone who is dysphoric in your body, and then as you move and move on, you continue.
Mm-hmm.
And coupled with this replacement, the hormone replacement therapy, you start using alcohol,
yeah.
right? And there's a moment where abuse happens in the home, so mm-hmm. there's an instance of intimate partner violence.
Yeah.
And, you know, you write about it and you say you don't remember,
mm-hmm.
right? But you see what's happening and you're like, what's happening? And I think it's really important for us to talk about it, right? To talk about that moment,
mm-hmm.
like reflecting back, right? Like, what do you think happened in that moment?
So, reflecting, I think I had a problem with alcohol abuse, number one. And number two, I had a lot of issues that I hadn't dealt with on an emotional and on a psychological level. So I was using the alcohol to mask my pain. And I mean, the partner that I talk about in the book at the time, she was undergoing the, rite of passage into becoming a sangon. So there were so many intertwined issues and realities. And I was battling to cope, and I wasn't telling anyone that I was coping. And so I started violently abusing alcohol. I think I had a blackout.
Mm-hmm.
And this blackout was coming from, I was very angry. But I don't know what triggered that anger.
Mm-hmm.
It goes back to the fact that I think I had so many issues and traumas that I hadn't dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
It was like Icarus falling very close to the sun and my wings were melting.
Mm-hmm.
And in that moment, I black out. I'm pissed drunk, and then things happen. There's armed response. I'm put in the back of this van. I'm ferried off to the police. But still, even there, I'm of the mind that I'll be out of here, because that's what we tend to do. Let me speak for myself. In intimate relationships, it's possible to undermine the other party,
mm-hmm.
and assume that whatever you do to them, they will always understand, or they will remember that, but this person is going through a transition, this person is taking hormones, still has childhood traumas that they haven't dealt with, and. And I'm actually quite happy that my then girlfriend didn't. We ended up dropping the charges, but I stayed a weekend in a cell with other males, and it was hectic.
Yes.
It was an eye-opener, and I couldn't even talk about being trans, because, again, the police have got this sick way, some of them, of if anyone tells them they're gender diverse, then they will do exactly what is going to cause you harm.
Mm.
And so I couldn't tell anyone, you know. But I got out of there, but my head was still very inflated. Because, I mean, come on, I've just gotten medical aid to approve my surgeries. I think there was a very self... I was an idiot.
Hmm.
And the doctors had told me about the results of alcohol abuse when you take hormones later in life. And I didn't listen. And so I'm happy that she put her foot down, especially when after I write about how I burnt her clothes. For me, it showed me just how deep my anger issues ran.
Hmm.
And a lot of
she was scapegoated, right?
Yeah.
So she was the unfortunate recipient of violence.
Of
she
my
was the
violence.
Of violence.
She was the
of my violence, yeah. And I mean, it regardless of what her personal journey was, I mean, we had intimate conversations about that. But regardless of what her personal journey was, I was very violent.
Mm.
And I think that's why it was important for me to also include that in the book. Because we don't want to talk intimate partner violence in the transgender community.
And do you think that there was an underlying tinge of toxic masculinity?
Yeah.
Right? So the idea of being socialized because you wanted to be this thing.
Yes.
And this thing means that there is authority.
So
this authority means I must beat up this person.
There's expectations
with
being a man in society, right?
Was it difficult to go back? I think to go back to that place, because myself. We often find ourselves at places of wokeness, but we don't want to talk about how we arrived there. Mm. And was it difficult to go back to that place? Because, I mean, reading it was very difficult. It was very
difficult.
It was very difficult to find out the ways in which you can also be a transgressor, mm-hmm. in which you can also be someone who perpetrates this toxicity.
I'm becoming everything that I hated, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Because you are the same person who had been abused by the mother.
So I should know better. So it was very difficult to write about. I mean, even during the editing phase, when Melinda got to that part, she's like, no, what happened to my sweet Landa? I'm like, Landa's also human. Mm-hmm. He's also fucked up. He's also done things that are unbecoming, that are untoward. And I think it's important to reflect Landa as truthfully as possible, which is why that part of the journey is important. But also for transgender men to realize that it can get hectic, especially if you don't align yourself with the journey fully. I got very toxic, I got very patriarchal because of these expectations. I played into society's hands, if I can put it like that, with no one forcing me. Do you get what I'm saying? And it can go south very quickly. So one has to be aware and within at all times. And I would actually suggest anyone who's in within 5 or 6 years of their journey to actually not drink. Because it also counters the hormones. I mean, you gain weight, it converts to estrogen, then we're back at square one. So, and your physical and mental health need to be 100%. It's quite a trying journey.
There's a lot of, like, joy in this book, you know, and we don't want to only focus on the painful and harrowing parts. There's a lot of joy in this book, and some of the joy is in the bathangs. You know? The Bethangs are where some of the joy is contained, you know?
Mm.
And I want to talk about how that relationship, because we've spoken about some of the toxic relationships, but how that particular romantic relationship then shaped so much of who you had wanted to become, you know? And you meeting yourself in this place where you are the lander that you want to be and not turning into everything that you've hated and everything that's hurt you, you know, and that's an important place to be, because we don't often think about joy in our journeys. Mm. We think of the pain, we think of the sadness, but joy is not a place where we often find ourselves.
To reflect on. No, when the lover and I started dating, I was very open and honest with her. And I think I had gotten to a point in my life where I saw myself for who I am.
Yeah.
And I realized that left unchecked and left to my own vices, I could become the monster that I so loathed. And so, I mean, even after the 2014 relationship, I go to AA meetings because I want to meet myself and look at myself and receive myself and work with what's there. I work on the anger, which is an ongoing process. You know, I work on the substance abuse. Mm. And so when I got into my relationship, I was at a point where I was brutally honest with myself. I wasn't sugarcoating anything. And I wanted to give anyone who saw a possible bae in me to know that this has been my journey.
Mm.
And I think that we don't talk about those a lot. We don't allow the other people to actually make an informed choice in terms of wanting to be with us. So Ulava, we talk, she knows that I come from a history of anger, of violence, you know, and we find ways to talk about that, you know. We allow each other space to breathe as well. She actually knows when my hormone levels are low.
Mm.
She will ask me, Lava, when is your next shot? And then she can pick up on my energy. So I think we're very energy connected, her and I. And she's been an amazing part of my life and my journey. She's been the hope that, you know, the hope that I hung on to and the love that I wanted to have. Because at some point I felt I wasn't worthy of love, you know, to give or receive. So it's compatibility. Understanding and knowing that she actually is one of those people who don't give a fuck what people think or say about her, which works for me because a lot of people are unpacking me, especially after the book, you know. So yeah, love has been a beautiful thing for me. I think it reinforced the idea that human beings always have a choice. Wherever you find yourself, you can choose love and you can choose the consequences of love. And so the reason why I'm saying is whatever happened to the parents in their childhoods or wherever they found themselves in a space where which led them to be who the people they were, they could have still chosen love because they did it so willingly with my younger siblings, you know. So yeah, it's love has been beautiful for me.
I find that to have been one of the most hopeful aspects of this book, and not just love in the romantic sense, but love in your friendships and the ways in which your friends held you, and the ways in which your maternal family also held you, you know. And I think so much of that also goes back to this idea of that deficit of love that you were talking about, right? And to see you come full circle in the book and come and arrive at this place where you are really at your truest self and still being held in love is such a powerful moment in the book. It's also such a hopeful moment for anyone reading this book who's then grappling with their own personal difficulties, right? Because you really, at that point in your life, you came quite nakedly. Like, here I am. This is what I bring to the table. I'm not performing anything for anyone anymore. And if this is not sufficient, then I don't know what...
Definitely. And I mean, I've been blessed to have the friends that I have, you know. Uta Ndeklas is one of those friends. You can invite her to a party, she won't come, but if you need her at 2 in the morning, she's there. You know, so, and she was very open with me, especially after my last relationship, that, Landa, you will probably have to sit down and have a conversation about your anger and how it's manifested so hectically and what you need to do to go back into the soul parts of who you are and work on it. So I've had those types of people who are very forthcoming. Uncle J.S., who was very blunt, you need to go for anger management. There's a big problem here. You know, so I've been blessed to have those people who call me out on my bullshit. And in calling me out, don't desert me. They still work with me in that love, you know? So yeah, love has been a beautiful theme.
I also really like your afterword. Yes. Because I think that it really speaks to this trance memo of triumph. You write, but humility is a work in progress. And there are times when I need to work on practicing tolerance. Whenever individual questions my genitalia, I'm reminded of how blinkered and obsessed with labels we humans are. Whatever lies between my legs, whether I sit or stand when I pee, my genitals are what they are and they serve their purpose. Whatever their shape, size, or name of them, and whether I have chosen to surgically align my body to my identity or not, I remain the man I've always been. But perhaps my greatest lesson, through all the pain, self-loathing, and hardship, has been able to embrace the beauty of the individuality and the importance of identity and self-love. Whatever decisions I've made regarding my body have been mine to make. I've been met with admiration by some and outright rejection by others, and still I remain me, Landa. The journey continues as life does, with all its ups and downs and ebbs and flows, the tapestry part woven and my purpose an ever fulfilling well of enlightenment. What a beautiful way to end a book. Just to speak about, like, I reject whatever notions you want to impose on me. So thank you, Landa.
What a book of triumph.
Right? In a world that seeks to erase you. As a black person, as a trans body, it seeks to erase you.
Completely.
So thank you for taking up the mantle of writing yourself back into history. Because this is the work of archiving the stories of black, queer, trans people in South Africa. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
And we're so grateful for the vulnerability and the honesty with which you wrote this story, particularly considering the way that our communities thrive on secrecy and on shame and on keeping these facades of perfection and what it means to step out of that, to know that you're stepping out of that alone and step into the great unknown of telling your story. Because I mean, at the time that you wrote the book, we were really starting, when this book came out, we were starting to have conversations about what it means to be transgender in this country, about the ways in which we harm and treat transgender violate transgender people. And this book comes out and then become so accessible, and you remain accessible, and we're so grateful for that. So, I mean, from the Cheeky Natives, we are just so grateful that you've done this work. And I don't think that anyone can read this book and then continue to be transphobic and trans and problematic in many ways. And I think that this is going to spur some very important questions and
dialogues,
because we need to have those dialogues. And I think that's something that you do with so much grace as well, is to have these dialogues with some very problematic people. And I mean, there's a grace that you extend there that we cannot honor enough, you know? So
now we come to the part we've all been waiting for.
I feel like we've been deep. Hey, this it's beautiful, because it was the idea that even in our depth, because I think often people are afraid to go into the deep things, right? Because it means that you must do the work of like unraveling.
Yeah.
You know, you must do the work of unraveling. But I think reading this, we went deep, but God, you come out of here and you're like, wow, this is what it means to triumph, you know, and so we're hopeful.
So we have to give you land,
because
we're in the business of reparation.
Yay!
Yes!
The land.
We want to give you land.
See, now we give land, Shing. We don't give our authors, I'm a stars, I don't know what you're going to do with stars. Like,
no, we want to give you land. And we want popcorn. To give you land, prime land, man.
Prime land. Now we give prime land. This is prime
this thing, this
real estate. prime real estate, land. Okay.
So I will give Elma the honors to give you, to bestow on you the land.
Guys, we're thinking I was never rich. So I'm going to, after deep consultation with my partner in the land commission, we've decided that we're going to give Landa land in Rondebosch.
Yay!
For a number of reasons. It's prime land. It is also close to the university, and it's close to the young people whose lives you're continuing to change. And we want you to continue to do the work that you're doing. It is such important. It's such important work. And also because that era is very symbolic. And when people read the book, they'll know why we chose that particular
the journey
era.
Back into it.
The journey. And we know that this is really the beginning of many wonderful, great things for you as you continue to travel and to tell your story and you empower people. And not just transgender people, but I think lots of people are going to read this book and identify with the story.
Yeah. No, I've had that. I've had great responses, you know, from people who were just broken and just need to find ways to mend themselves, you know. So, yeah.
Thank you, Landa. Thank you so much. Thank you very much. So, we'll catch you on the next episode of the Cheeky Natives with Cheeky Conversations.
Yes.
Bye.